sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, hey, hey. It's a sunny day.
It's just
day.
A sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. A shortened edition of the KSL Greenhouse this morning as we make way for our BYU basketball coverage. The home show comes up at 10, and then pregame coverage begins at 11 right here on KSL News Radio. Top of the hour feature, we want to talk with a special guest this morning. We're going to talk about giant pumpkins, and with us is Clint Nash, the president of the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers. And Clint, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Interesting topic. How in the world do you get those pumpkins that size?
Yeah, it's pretty, There's a lot of work to it. I grew my first pumpkin about 1999, I think it planted there, 2000, and you know it got just over 100 pounds. I'm like, this thing's huge. It's so, and I found some. There is a certain seed, a certain type of pumpkin, the Atlantic dill, and the genetics on that. We're not totally sure what all they're capable of, but it can produce some just gigantic pumpkins. So it's pretty fun to see.
So for our listeners, the giant pumpkins, and we're not talking about big jack-o'-lanterns, but we're talking about pumpkins that can weigh over 1,000 pounds if you do everything right and the climate works for you. But if someone wants to get started, you know, they've got small kids or just might become a hobby, what do you recommend to folks that want to get started with giant pumpkins?
So, yeah, I mean, this is a good time of year to do that. So, the club here is the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers. So we have a few ways to help people get started. We're actually doing a little seminar at Mountain Valley Seeds in Salt Lake next month on March 23rd. We're going to have a couple people that have grown these pumpkins. We're going to have a class on some of the basics on what to do and kind of just, you know, explain some of the basic things. Again, you can go, you know, depending on how much time and money you have to spend on it, you can just spend a little and have just a little bit of time and still get a really big pumpkin. And then we're going to have a more advanced class and everything. And also on our website, but pretty much seeds. So we have seeds for people. If you go to UtahPumpkinGrowers.com, there are different ways we can get you seeds. That's the key. That's the first thing is you need one of these seeds, which we have some for people. For people that want to try this, and then from there, you know, there's also some explanation on our website about some of the, you know, steps you need to do to grow them, you know, as big as you want and can or whatever. But
okay, Clint, I have to ask you though, you've been doing this since 1999. Why is this your passion?
Yeah, it's crazy. I know it's, so I mean, I have a lot of hobbies and stuff. It's just, to me, I just love seeing things grow. And so I originally planted a garden to grow stuff to make salsa. It was one of my favorite foods. Like, you know, I grew tomatoes and peppers and stuff. And then I saw a packet of seeds in a store saying, you know, you could grow up to 100 pounds. I'm like, wow, that'd be crazy. So I did that, and then I just kind of got addicted to it. Now, there are other, I try to grow giant gourds now and stuff too. But these pumpkins, like, it's crazy. They can grow up to 50 pounds a day. I mean, if you weren't doing anything in the day, like, especially when they're smaller, you could probably sit and actually noticeably see them grow. That's how fast they can grow.
What do you do with them after you've grown them to that huge size?
Oh, we have some fun with them, but we actually have a regatta out at Daybreak in mid-October where if they're over about 500 pounds, an average size adult can use them as a boat. So you can, so we'll kind of, you know, cover out the top, get, take all the insides out, and you can sit in them, and we actually race them across the lake. We also, toward the end of the year, we drop them on cars and stuff like that with a crane. We have a fun event where we do that. And then, you know, we've had them carved into, it's fun to have them carved into different, things, you know, with that big of a size. We have some really great pumpkin carvers here in Utah that do that. And so there's a lot of fun that you can have with them.
Okay. I need a couple of quick tips on how to just grow giant pumpkins before we let you go. Give us a couple of quick tips.
Yeah. So again, you need one of these seeds, Atlantic Dill. Make sure you get that type of seed. And then pretty much if you want to get it as big as possible, you want to make sure there's only one pumpkin on there. So pick off all the other, you know, you're going to, I mean, we hand pollinate them. You don't have to necessarily do that. But once you have a pumpkin, if you want to max it out, only use that one. You can also bury vines because the plant will feed off everywhere that a leaf comes up. Below that, a root will grow under. And if you water the entire plant, bury the vines, it's going to suck up nutrients from the entire plant and feed that pumpkin. So those are some of the basic things. And then pretty much just try to keep them healthy. There's, you know, I have an insect net that I put over it because I've had such issues with squash bugs and stuff like that. But trying to keep them as healthy as possible, water them enough, feed them, you know, water the entire plant. Those are the basic things to get started and you know, to get one of these giant pumpkins.
All right. This is a pretty competitive group, isn't it?
Yeah, we definitely have fun with it. But, yeah, so, you know, we have a couple of way-off events at the end of the year. We have one up in Logan on Center Street, which is really fun up there in Cache Valley. And then we have one at Gateway. So, like, last year, so my pumpkin was just a little bit smaller than my good friend Dave. And he – but when they came to the weight, mine actually weighed just a little bit more. So it was – I know, really disappointing to him, but we do have fun with it. We are competitive, but we also, you know, we have fun doing that. We kind of push each other to, you know.
All right, Clint, we appreciate you being with us. And again, for those folks who want to know more, want to take a class, March 23rd at Mid Valley Seeds, and you can find the seeds and more information at utahpumpkingrowers.com.
I think that Mountain Valley is the other name for that is True Leaf Market, is kind of the encompassing. So if you're more familiar with True Leaf Market, that should be the same place. So.
Okay. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Anton with you. Number to call 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, says they have a 10-year-old Zelkova tree in their park strip and one root is starting to lift the sidewalk. Ooh. And they plan on cutting it out, but they want any suggestions.
And that may be the option. Unfortunately, you know, a Zelkova, if it's just regular village green or green vase, will get 40 feet tall. And in a 3-foot wide park strip, that will lift the sidewalk over time.
Does it hurt the tree when you cut it out?
Absolutely, it does. And it makes the tree more prone to toppling and wind because that root isn't stabilizing and anchoring the tree from that direction.
But there's not much else they can
do. No, there's not. There's not much else they can do. And so if you put Zelkovas in a park strip, you need to do City Sprite or... oh, what's the other? There's a couple of them that are just beautiful little trees that get 15 to 20 feet instead of the wireless is the other one. And I don't know why they would have named it that, but the implication is that it doesn't grow up into power lines. That's why they called it wireless Zelkova. So, but wireless and City Sprite are the two, but unfortunately that's the option.
Next listener is in West Davis County, and they want to know, can they start trimming their dogwood and Rose of Sharon?
Give it another. I mean, if they need to, they definitely can. It's the chances, just looking at the longer-term forecast, we're supposed to stay warmer. But if we dip down into single digits or, you know, around 8 or 10 degrees and they've just pruned, with plants already starting to slowly break dormancy, they could run into a few problems. So 90% chance they will be absolutely fine, but if they can wait another 3 weeks, I would.
The next person wants to know if they can begin overseeding.
Yeah, if it's in the grass, that's fine. If you may run the risk of birds finding the seed, but if it's in between the existing grass, then it's much harder for them. That's fine.
We're seeing a bunch of primrose in the markets, and this next listener wants to know, when can they plant them outside?
I would give it until mid to late March.
Okay. Chuck is on the line in Spanish Fork. Good morning, Chuck. What was your question?
Good morning. Yes, a couple of years ago, I bought two peach trees from Bare Root, and last summer, I bought some spray to spray on them to keep the borers away. But last week, I was out looking at them, and one of them looks like it's got sap coming out of the near the base, and I sprayed that stuff like once a week or every week. It was, I can't remember the name of the stuff I used that they recommended from the nursery, but I'm wondering what more can I do, and is my tree going to survive this?
Well, you can go dig around the tree a little bit and see if the gum is right at the base of the tree, at the soil level or just a little below. That's probably a borer of some type. It could be greater peach tree borer. It could also be a flat headed borer. But at this point, there's really nothing you can do. Just let it come out. And the tree's not necessarily dead, but I would probably, if you're spraying weekly, they probably gave you a product containing spinosad. And I would switch over to maybe something along the lines of the high yield pet garden and livestock spray. It's a little bit stronger and you focus on the base of the tree, especially. So you spray the lower limbs and trunk and really focus around the base at the soil level. And you're going to spray from early June through mid September.
Okay, so that's the only thing I can do to prevent these is a spray. I can't wrap the base of the tree.
No, you can't. They'll get through it, and that's actually going to potentially harbor more pests and diseases. You can wrap the tree in the winter with a white tree tape, but it needs to come off in March. And what you're doing with that wrap is actually keeping the trunk cooler so that it doesn't heat up in the sunlight and have sap flow that then the sap freezes at night and damages the bark and attracts the borers in because it's a damaged tree. But there's no barrier that you can put on there, paint or wrap, that will keep those out, that won't potentially do more harm to the tree than just having the tree sprayed once a week.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, Chuck, thanks for your call this morning. I know we just talked about overseeding, Ton, but seeding lawn is a little bit different.
No,
still too early.
It is. The birds will come in and just clean your seed out. So sometime in April, just when you can work the soil and nighttime temperatures are in at least in the 40s.
Next person would like to know, is the slender, I believe it's pronounced Hinoki cypress, a good tree for northern Utah?
It's okay. It may need a little afternoon shade. Hinoki cypress is especially conifer here where it's a little bit cooler in the summer and more humidity. It's much more common, but there are several cypress and species that we grow here on a limited basis that if you have them where they don't get a lot of reflected heat or maybe even a little bit of afternoon shade, they do okay.
Most popular questions today, when can I trim my rose bushes and when can I plant grass seed?
Mid-March for the roses.
It's so funny because they're just, you know, those are the questions that are coming in this morning. One that I have for you, I was mentioning how the crocus are just doing great and the flower beds, they look beautiful, but what about those that are getting into my lawn?
They're okay.
But won't they eventually just expand and like just take over the lawn?
Well, they
or
may,
does it just
it's
kind
not
of
that they take
choke
over
them out.
The lawn, but as you mow and the leaves are still intact, that will reduce their vigor. But they go dormant so early that crocus in the lawn are not usually a concern. And, you know, my 25 years working in horticulture, no one has ever said crocus have taken over my lawn.
Yeah.
You know, there are other bulbs, especially like Star of Bethlehem, which are very problematic.
Oh, right.
But the crocus, because they're usually done by April, they just aren't too much of a concern.
Right. And plus they have just such, the foliage is just so thin that
it
it's
is.
Not as big a deal as some of the other things.
And when they're done blooming, especially after a mowing, they just blend right into the grass.
Yeah, it's not really a problem. Next question for you. Grass growing into the flower beds. I've noticed, I don't know, everything seems to grow in the winter that you don't want to grow. But man, I have one section, and I know this is a problem for others, where I have just a ton of grass growing into the flower beds.
Is it from the lawn?
Mm-hmm.
All you can really do is every month to 6 weeks.
This is properties that are, you know, a couple
yeah.
decades old, right?
Yeah, you have to get a spade and just re-edge the flower bed. And get that spade 6 inches to a foot deep so it severs the roots and the underground runners of the Kentucky bluegrass. But if you'll do that every 6 weeks and it is some work, they will behave. But if you don't, those underground runners, which are, you know, 6 inches to a foot underground, will start popping up in your flower beds.
Okay. So I need to do some serious work in my front flower bed. All right, number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. Taking your calls at 801-575-8255. Text us at 57500. Next listener, Ton, wants to know, what kind of broadleaf weed and grass killers can they use in the temperatures that we have right now?
None. It's just too cold. You know, it needs to be above 55 for a good 24 hours or at least a 12-hour block. And, it, you know, if anything, hand pull. If the weeds are up, maybe a weed torch just because it's cool and, you know, the soil's moist and things. But mm-hmm. you're usually into mid to late March before it's warm enough for broadleaf weed killers. And so glyphosate products, it needs to be above 55. There are some specialized lawn weed killers that are mostly for professionals that can be used at temperatures around 55. They're nothing to be fooled with by beginners, but generally late March is the soonest.
Next listener says they put straw from their chicken coop over their raised vegetable beds. Will it break down, or do they need to remove the straw before planting this spring?
You know, if it was just on the surface, they may be able to plant through it, you know, giving room for seeds and different things. But I think the thing I wouldn't recommend is tilling it in at this point. That straw takes a while to break down, and it can actually rob the soil of nitrogen. And so if there was a lot of chicken manure in it, I might get a soil test done to make sure that the soil is not too salty. And if it were, there are things they can do by leaching the salts out. But, you know, I would get a soil test done to know for sure.
Better tell them how they do that.
So there's two ways. BYU and USU both test soil locally. And you go to usual.usu.edu. So usual.usu.edu, and you want the routine test, or you can call BYU's analytical laboratory and just say you've had some manure on some raised beds over the winter and what testing they recommend. But the cost for either lab before shipping, you know, you've got to ship them as samples around $30 to $35.
Okay, next listener wants some ideas on how to manage yucca plants, like trimming the dead leaves and such.
I cut the dead leaves out and otherwise just leave them be. I don't know what specifically they're looking for. When they flower, you can cut the flower head out toward the base so you can deadhead it that way, but they're pretty low maintenance.
Okay. Do they get really big, though? Can you control the size a
little
bit?
You can't. If you try to dig around them, a lot of times you leave roots behind and you start just getting pups coming up everywhere.
Oh.
So you need to plant a species that will stay within the confines you want. And so the standard one is called Adam's needle yucca. And most of them are spineless. They won't, when you walk against them, they don't poke you. But there are other yucca out there that stay smaller or bigger depending on your needs. But an Adam's needle yucca, which is 90%, which or 90% of what we grow, over 20 years will spread 3 or 4 feet with pups coming up, and you get a bed of them instead of just one.
I don't have that much space.
No, and so they may need to look into some of the smaller yucca.
All right. Garth is on the line in Grantsville. Good morning, Garth. What was your question this morning?
My question, I heard you talking about dormant oil, but what about copper fungicide? When would be a good time to apply that?
I would give it until mid-March and download that homeowner pest management guide, and it'll give you the timing according to bud stages. And there, I wish I could just give you a calendar date, but because all years are different, like this year, we're probably going to move the trees along a little faster. Last year, it may have been late March or early April, but this year it may be mid-March. And so you can see those pictures of the bud stages in that home orchard pest management guide, and it'll tell you when to do the copper spray according to the bud stage. And you just look at the tree and compare them. The other thing is subscribing to the USU Pest Lab updates, and they will tell you usually down to the day when you need to spray.
Okay. I have one other question. What about buying weed in your lawn? When's a good time to try to get rid of that?
Oh, if you're using quinclorac in mid-spring is fine. So when it starts to come up and the vines are around 6 inches to a foot long and haven't really started to flower yet is when you would spray.
Okay.
And you want a quinclorac product.
Okay. Is that the... Or is that like a WD or 2,4-D?
No, it's not. It's not. Right. It's the some product names would include Q4 Plus is one. And that does have, I think it might have 2,4-D in it, but Q4 Plus or Image all-in-one lawn weed killer.
Okay. And that is the big box stores, or do I need
You're going to have to go to an IFA or Steve Regan or a local garden center for both of them.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Garth, thanks for your call this morning. Yeah, somebody on there said, yeah, the pups on the yucca come up everywhere.
They do.
Okay. Ron is now on the line in Orem. Good morning, Ron. What was your question?
Yes. I wonder if you could talk to the idea of planting an Asian pear tree. I understand they're susceptible to fire blight, and if there's anything I can do to help prevent that?
There is, and there's a few things you can do. I think Colorado State has a list of Asian pear varieties that are at least moderately resistant to fire blight, that you could look for those varieties. They aren't the Nishiki or 20th Century or some of these that are super common at the garden centers, but they are out there. But otherwise, what you're going to want to do is prune minimally so that you are not creating, if you prune too much, it creates a lot of juvenile growth, which is much more susceptible to the blight than mature growth. And so you prune in the spring, you're only cutting around 10 to 15% of the branches out. You're going to be proactive looking for the cankers. And then when the trees are in blossom, you're going to need to use a fire blight spray on those blossoms and watch USU's updates so that you can do everything you can to prevent the infections.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, Ron. Thanks so much for your call this morning. We're going to take a break, come back with the final segment of the show. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open and you can text us at 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton taking your calls and questions. We have Jeanette, who is on the line in Orem this morning. And good morning, Jeanette. What was your question?
Oh, good. Thank you. We have a kind of a weed that's out here next to our house, and we've been working on it. It's like a dark clover, and it has little yellow flowers on them. And it seems like the more we dig them up, the more they seem to produce. Is there a pre-emergent or something that we could put on them to get rid of them?
Is it in your lawn?
No.
Okay. So where is it coming up? Is it a gravel drive or what's the situation?
It's just right next to our house where we have plants and whatever.
Okay.
And it's just, I've never seen anything like this before. It just
Are you
really...
growing any edible plants in that area?
No. Well, down the okay. way we did, but not there.
Okay, it's a plant called black medic, and it's actually related to clover, but it's more closely related to alfalfa. And it's a biennial or short-lived perennial plant. And so what I would recommend doing is digging out, if it's not too much of a chore, digging out anything you can find to get bare ground, and then using a pre-emergent gallery would be the one I would use. I'm trying to remember the active in that. It's not prodiamine. It's isoxaben. So let me have you write down a name, because if you can't find the trade name gallery, isoxaben is usually available from local garden centers. And so it's spelled I-S... I-S-O-X-A-B-I-N, I believe, isoxaben. And that particular pre-emergent is good for broadleaf weeds. So anything coming from seed. And so if you had that cleaned out and you knew that it was relatively weed-free, you could put isoxaben in there. But if you put a pre-emergent down, you cannot grow anything in that bed from seed.
Oh, That's good to know, because I have a couple of lily plants that are in there, too, and that was what was concerning me.
Well, the isoxaben won't hurt your lilies because they're already established. But if they, let's say you took a sweet alyssum seed out there and spread it, the isoxaben would kill it as it tried to germinate.
Oh, okay. Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate
that. Yeah, so
this.
You would just, I mean, it's kind of like preen, and you could try some preen in there, too. But the isoxaben, I think, is going to be a little more critical because it just does a lot better job against those broadleafed weeds than many other pre-emergent products.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
All right. Thanks for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, says they want to replace their heavily shaded grass lawn with native plants. They have no idea where to start. Do you have advice or resources that they should check out?
For the time we have, I mean, this is a 15-minute conversation at least.
Oh.
But if the grass is dying out, there's a lot of native plants that will not thrive in that. If the shade's so deep that it's killing the grass, that you're just not going to go in there with native plants and have them thrive. And so they're going to need to try to get more sunlight in there. And then there are many shade tolerant native plants, starting with like some native coral berries or snowberries, out in some currants and things, and we could have that conversation. But if the shade is so deep that it's killing the grass, I think that most natives would struggle.
Okay. Next listener wants advice on removing a choke cherry from the middle of a lilac bush without hurting the lilac.
It's doable.
Okay.
And what they would need to do is cut the choke cherry so that there's still some stump left. I would leave at least a foot and then go in there with concentrated Roundup. And just, you might have to use almost like an eyedropper or one of those science stylets that are not stylets, but the, what do you call them? They suck up liquids. They're plastic in any rate. And you're just going to drizzle that over the fresh cut stump. So you're not getting it on the lilac. Glyphosate, the active ingredient, isn't soil active. And so it stays in the root system of the cherry and doesn't harm the lilac. If they were to use something like Toradon, that would kill the lilac too.
Okay. Next listener wants to know, what are grape leaf miners and how do they prevent them?
Grape leaf miners are just a pest insect that over the last 10 or 15 years have become much more problematic. And they suck the juice out of the leaves in late summers when they're at their peak. And so if you have had them and they've really damaged your grapes, you need to go in starting in July and watch for them. And when you see them, you need to do a spray. But if you have not thinned your grapes and pruned them annually, it's very difficult because the vines are so thick. But you have to spray the undersides of the leaves. And you may be able to use a spinosad product, but there are some yard and garden sprays out there that are registered for them. But people will go, like, oh, I sprayed. It's usually they didn't spray the undersides of the leaves.
Okay, final question of the morning. Person's having problems with pavement ants, and when they want to know when to apply and what type of poison.
When they are active, there's several options. The slower acting baits are probably the best longer term solution, because the ants, it's just a food that the ants like that have a slow acting poison that they feed to the queen, and then the queen eats it and dies, and then the colony dies out. They may have to try two or three of them.
All right, that's it for the KSL Greenhouse Show for this week. A complete show next week from 8 to 11. And if you didn't get enough of the greenhouse, you woke up late, you can check us out in podcast form at KSLpodcast.com. Some of our features this morning, the plant of the week was the tulip, and then we talked about giant pumpkins at 9 o'clock. So you can catch that on the podcast, or you can find out more information on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Ton, have a great weekend. And then we'll see you all on Monday at noon.